I doubt you'll find a more explosive opening to a Christian book than the first two sentences of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's classic, The Cost of Discipleship. They go like this: cheap grace is the deadly enemy of our church. We are fighting today for costly grace. That's how Bonhoeffer begins his book. Now, four times over the last few minutes, we sang that refrain about grace being free. And that's not a rogue song unrepresentative of our hymnody. We often sing these words: come ye needy, come and welcome, God's free bounty glorify. True belief and true repentance, every grace that brings us nigh, without money, come to Jesus Christ and buy. All of which raises the question then, who is right? Is Bonhoeffer right, or are these hymns right? Is God's grace costly, or is God's grace costless? Well, the answer is Bonhoeffer's right and the hymns are right. God's grace is costly and God's grace is costless. It isn't an either or situation, it's a both and situation. And I would put it to you that this tension between the costlessness of God's grace and the costliness of God's grace is illustrated well in our passage this evening, in the story of Naaman. He, of course, experiences God's grace. He experiences God's grace in the healing of his leprosy. That's in the previous passage that we looked at 2 weeks ago. But more than that, it's evident in this next section, he experiences God's grace in what we would call conversion. He becomes a believing worshipper of the living and true God. Naaman experiences God's grace. And in Naaman's experience of God's grace, then, we see these two realities. We see that God's grace is costless, and we see that God's grace is costly. Let's look this evening at each of those in turn. So first of all, God's grace is costless. God's grace is costless. So at the end of verse 15, Naaman, cured now from the ravages of ill health in his body, cured now from the ravages of false gods in his heart, utters these words to Elisha: accept now a present from your servant. He wants to give the prophet something. But Elisha won't let him, even though in verse 16 Naaman tries to insist on it. Elisha won't let him. And I suppose we might smile at that and say, oh, typical Elisha. Elisha is a strong-willed fellow who doesn't respond to people being insistent with him. And Elisha is an independent fellow who doesn't allow people to do things for him. Verse 16 is typical of the man. But actually, that kind of image of Elisha is a caricature. He isn't really like that at all. He isn't strong-willed in chapter 3 when the king of Israel and his cronies are in a mess and they visit Elisha, and Elisha initially tells them to get lost, chapter 3, verse 13, but the king of Israel presses him and Elisha does come to their aid. He responds there to people being insistent with him. And he isn't independent in chapter 4 when accepting frequent hospitality from the Shunammite woman, or at the end of that chapter when accepting food from that man from Baal Shalisha. In those instances, he allows people to do things for him. So verse 16 of our passage here isn't actually typical Elisha. He acts in an atypical way. This is out of character. So what's he doing? Why doesn't he just eventually say, okay, seeing as you insist, Naaman, I'll take a gift. My ministry, after all, in these famine-afflicted times and with 100 sons of the prophets often dependent on me, is a little precarious. Your donation will be useful and will assist God's work that I and my colleagues are engaged in. I'll take it, Naaman. Why not that kind of response? Why this unusual digging in of his heels here? Well, presumably because when Naaman wants to do something for him, Elisha detects a different motive than when the Shunammite woman wants to do something for him, and then when the man from Baal Shalisha wants to do something for him. In those two cases, it is just about assisting God's work. It's the equivalent of the Philippian church sending through Epaphroditus a gift to the imprisoned Apostle Paul. It's the equivalent of NREC regularly sending via EMF a certain amount of money to David Koziol. And Elisha, like Paul and like our brother David, has no problem with that. In Naaman's case, however, it isn't just about assisting God's work. In Naaman's case, it's about making a payment for the grace of God he has experienced. You see, it isn't a spontaneous thought on Naaman's part. It isn't that he's struck by the impoverished circumstances in which Elisha is conducting his ministry and he thinks, well, I just want to help this guy a bit. No, Naaman loaded his chariots with riches back in verse 5 when he was still in Syria, when he still thought that the man to whom he was being sent in Israel was a grand and impressive figure. So why did he do that? Why did he load his chariot with riches? Because it was just intuitive to him. If you receive some significant benefit from a god, you offer payment. In the religions of the ancient world, there was no such thing as a free lunch. And so obviously, having healed him, this Israelite god Yahweh would be owed something. He would be due a whole load of silver and gold and luxurious garments. I'm saying that's the motive, that's the thinking that Elisha detects as Naaman speaks in verse 15 of this present that he wants to give. It may seem comparable with the Shunammite woman building for the prophet an extension to her house. In actual fact, there's all the difference in the world between the two actions. One is supporting a ministry, the other is repaying a god. One is funding a good cause, the other is effectively purchasing God's grace. And Elisha refuses Naaman's offer then because Naaman needs to realize it doesn't work like that. You don't purchase God's grace. God's grace is costless. It's free of charge. I wonder, do you realize that? Do you realize that God is offering you this evening the cancellation of all your sins, membership of his own very family, a close and happy relationship with himself, eternal joy in a fantastic new world, and he charges you absolutely nothing. You don't have to buy it with money. You don't have to earn it with good behavior. You don't have to merit it with religious zeal. You can just take it as you are tonight. Without any thought of affordability, without any thought of amassing the necessary resources first. If you don't believe me, then think of that criminal on the cross alongside Jesus as he's on the cross at Calvary. And Jesus speaks to him, doesn't he, of gaining paradise. What does that man have with which to pay for a place in paradise? He has nothing. No possessions, no record of a decent life. He has nothing. And he's not even eligible for a buy now, pay later deal because he's within a few minutes of dying. And yet Jesus assures him that paradise is his. It's his as a sheer gift received through helpless trust in Jesus. And paradise can be yours on exactly the same basis. You don't need to take to God any payment at all. All you take to him is your guilt and your sin-addicted heart for him to deal with. That's all you take to him. You need to understand this. God's grace is costless. God's grace is costless. He offers you everything tonight. He offers you Jesus Christ, his Son, and a multitude of good things in him. And he charges you nothing. Gehazi's main problem is that he doesn't get this. You might think his main problem is greed. He just can't resist the pull of Naaman's riches. I'm not convinced that that is Gehazi's main problem. For one thing, if that's the case, why doesn't he ask Naaman for more? Why doesn't he run after Naaman and tell him that all 100 sons of the prophets have suddenly turned up on Elisha's doorstep? And Elisha needs a whole lot more than just a couple of items of clothing. Why does he merely scratch the surface of all the treasures that Naaman has in that chariot to give him? For another thing, it's interesting that Gehazi says in verse 20, "As the Lord lives, I will run after Naaman and get something from him." He invokes God's name. Now, I said last Sunday morning when preaching on the third commandment that invoking God's name could be useful as a cover for bad behavior. But there's no evidence here that Gehazi is speaking to anyone. He seems to be speaking to himself. And so he doesn't really need to invoke God's name to cover from himself his own bad behavior. Presumably, his use of God's name reflects a conviction that he has that he's genuinely acting in a righteous, God-pleasing way here. How could he possibly have that conviction? Well, that leads us to a third thing. And I pointed this out last time in verse 20. He refers, notice, to Naaman, not simply as Naaman, but as Naaman the Syrian. And I think we should read that imagining him kind of spitting out those words. Naaman the Syrian. The Syrian. I think Gehazi genuinely believes that his master's theology is wrong in this case. That for Gentiles like Naaman, God's grace isn't costless. And Elisha, therefore, should be requiring some payment from this guy. And so he, Gehazi, is doing the righteous thing by remedying that and going after this Gentile and making sure he does at least pay something for the experience of God's grace that he has had. Gehazi doesn't get that God's grace is free for everyone. He might get that God's grace is free for some people, for people like Elisha and for people like him, for people who are kosher, for people who are Hebrew, for people who are circumcised, for people who belong to the special people. But it's not free for everyone. It's not free for uncircumcised Syrians. By the way, Elisha's question there in verse 26 to Gehazi, was it a time to accept money and garments and so on, probably means something like this. Gehazi, just as Naaman was going back to Syria, pondering my refusal of his gift, pondering what kind of a God Yahweh must be to pour out his grace and demand no payment in return, at that point, of all points, you show up and threaten to undermine the whole thing by demanding payment after all. Elisha's angry. He's angry that an embryonic Gentile believer has been tempted to think wrongly about God because of the action of Elisha's own servant who should know better. But as I say, Gehazi's main problem then is that he just doesn't get that God's grace is free for everyone. Perhaps you're someone this evening who has received God's grace as a free gift. You're a Christian. But perhaps you struggle with the idea of others doing so, or at least of certain others doing so. Remember the elder brother in Jesus' famous parable? He struggled with it, didn't he? He felt that his father was being far too generous, far too easy on the younger brother. He was being naive. This lad had been up to all kinds of stuff in that far country. He surely had to do something a bit more than just show up again for the fatted calf to be brought out. Are there people whose conversions to Christ would produce a similar reaction in you, I wonder? Are there people whose conversions to Christ would produce a similar reaction in me? Oh, to retain throughout our Christian lives the deep-seated conviction that there's not a man, a woman, a boy, or girl in the whole world who won't be given all the blessings of salvation without cost on coming to God through faith. God's grace is costless. Let's reconvince ourselves of this tonight. God's grace is costless. You come empty-handed to God, and he pours, requiring nothing from you in return, all the blessings of salvation. God's grace is costless. But then let's notice, secondly, this evening, God's grace is costly. God's grace is costly. So when Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote his book arguing for the concept of costly grace, he wasn't denying everything that I've said in this sermon so far this evening. He wasn't denying the doctrine that I've set before you again, that you go to God empty-handed and without cost, he gives you salvation. Nor was Bonhoeffer talking about the costliness of saving grace to God himself. That, of course, is true. It costs God everything, as he gave his son to the horrors of Golgotha's cross. But that's not what Bonhoeffer is talking about either. No, Bonhoeffer's concern was the idea that because we're saved by grace, it doesn't matter how we as Christians live subsequently. That idea disgusted Bonhoeffer. It was an idea that he saw rife in the Lutheran church of his day, that could turn a blind eye to all that Hitler and the Nazi party was doing. We're saved by grace. We don't have to stand up for anything. We don't have to raise our heads above the parapet. We're saved by grace. He was disgusted by that concept. And he said that it turns God's grace into something cheap. Something cheap. And he was right there. He was right. I read an article recently, and I can't remember now where I read it or who it was by either. But I do remember roughly what it was about. It was about Jonathan Edwards' biography of the missionary David Brainerd, the 18th century missionary to the Native Americans. And the article was basically saying that this book is dangerous. It's a dangerous book. But he didn't mean then by that the book has some kind of radioactivity in its pages, or that it's inclined to spontaneously combust when it's on your lap and you're reading it, or that it has sharp corners which can easily cut you, or anything like that. No, the writer of the article meant the book is dangerous in the sense of how you are inclined to live after you've read it. The article traced the influence of the book on William Carey and on Adoniram Judson and on Jim Elliot. In other words, after reading that book, the article was saying you might well just give up everything. You might well go out on the mission field. You might well end up dying a martyr's death. And God's grace then is costly in rather the same way that Edward's book is dangerous. Not in the sense that you have to pay a fortune to obtain it. We've already seen you pay nothing. No, God's grace is costly in the sense of how you're inclined to live after you've tasted it. And we see this then in this man, Naaman. Having experienced God's grace, Naaman doesn't go back to Syria to resume glibly his old life there. No, receiving God's grace has left Naaman different. Let me show you what I mean then by means of three words. First of all, confession. Confession. Naaman goes back to Syria with that confession that we have in verse 15. Naaman said, "Behold, I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel." That's Naaman's new confession. That's his confession of faith. And I think it's probably difficult for us to appreciate just how bonkers that confession was going to sound in the land of Syria. Sadly, even in Israel, actually, it sounded pretty bonkers to most people. Remember how back in chapter 1 of this book, we have an Israelite king who seems to think that Israel is the last place where you're going to find a god. So Elijah has to send that repeated message to him. Is it because there is no God in Israel that you are going to inquire of Baal-zebub, the god of Ekron? So we have an Israelite king who should be the model of piety, the model of exclusive allegiance to Yahweh. We have an Israelite king who seems to think Israel is the last place you're going to find a god. Naaman is going to go around Syria now announcing that Israel is the only place you're going to find a god. That nowhere else in the world is there a god except in the land of Israel. And so you see then how God's grace has this weighty implication for Naaman. It leaves him with this phenomenally countercultural confession on his lips. And experiencing God's grace still has that implication, doesn't it? Even for us, in the UK, with its fairly recent, fairly Christian past, even for us now, increasingly at least, the experience of God's grace leaves us with a confession that sounds crazy, insane, bonkers, or even perhaps sinister to men and women around us. It leaves us confessing things about marriage and confessing things about the end of history and confessing things about hell, and confessing things about a devil called Satan, and confessing a whole load of other things that at least raises eyebrows and perhaps provokes hostility. And in that way then, God's grace is costly. This is what it does to us. It places on our lips an explosive confession that goes down like a lead balloon with people around us. Confession. Second word, maintenance. Maintenance. So we have, don't we, this detail in verse 17 of Naaman requesting 2 mule loads of earth. Now, commentators tend to seize then on the subsequent reference in the second half of verse 17 to burnt offerings and sacrifices that Naaman plans to offer to Yahweh once he's back in Syria, and they link the earth very much with the offerings and sacrifices themselves, and they say that Naaman was going to build an altar in Syria, and he couldn't countenance the idea of building an altar to Yahweh that wasn't laid on Israelite soil, and so that's why he wants to take all this soil back with him. I think it's better to focus on the 3 words from now on, there in the second half of verse 17, and to link the 2 mule loads of earth with that little phrase, from now on. From now on, your servant will offer sacrifices only to Yahweh. Now, that's a huge pledge, isn't it? We don't know how old Naaman is, but it was worth him getting healed of his leprosy. Presumably, he still is expected to have quite a chunk of his life remaining. And so this is quite a pledge. From now on, for the rest of my days, I am only going to offer sacrifices to Yahweh. And it's a pledge that's easily uttered then. But it's a pledge that's going to be much harder to keep at the forefront of his mind and his lifestyle. And I think then the 2 mule loads of earth are connected with that, and they are going to be some kind of aide memoir for Naaman. He's going to walk out of his door every morning and see this mound of earth in his garden. And that's not going to let him forget what happened to him and how he once went to Israel and he discovered there the true and living God. And he's now a worshipper of that God. I was listening recently to an interview with Stephen Fry, and he was talking about tithes and he was saying that he loves ties, and one of the reasons he loves ties is because a lot of his ties remind him of certain experiences in his life. And he talked about one particular tie. He'd been in New York on Madison Avenue back in the 1980s, and he'd been wandering along, and he suddenly spotted the artist Andy Warhol, and he was rather intrigued by what Andy Warhol was doing, and so he kind of followed him along the street a little way behind him. And Warhol went into the flagship Versace store there in Madison Avenue, and he was clearly acquainted with the management there, and he started kind of drinking coffee, and Stephen Fry was just kind of mesmerized by this, and he was kind of standing in just inside the shop, kind of watching what Andy Warhol was doing, when a member of staff suddenly strode over to him, to Stephen Fry, and said, "Can I help you, sir?" And he felt rather embarrassed. He couldn't say, "Well, I'm here just watching Andy Warhol." And so he said, "Oh, yeah, I'll get that tie there." And so he purchased a tie, and he says then whenever he wears that tie now, he remembers that particular experience. And I think then this mound of earth for Naaman would have served a similar function. It would have reminded him every time he saw it that he was now a worshipper of the God he'd encountered in the place where that soil came from. By the way, rather striking, isn't it, that this is the same man who not so long ago was refusing to dip in the River Jordan because the water there is so inferior to the rivers that he was used to. Why was the water inferior? Why? What's wrong with the Jordan? Well, we're told that it's a pretty clay river and discolored for that reason. And so Israelite soil was precisely the problem with the River Jordan, the very reason that he was so averse to dipping in it. And now he loves Israelite soil. Now he wants to take a whole load of it back with him. It's a wonderful little reminder, isn't it, of how our whole outlook changes in conversion. It reminds me of a story about Douglas Macmillan, the 20th century Scottish preacher and evangelist, and he was pastoring a church, and there were these two lads in the church, and they would come along Sunday by Sunday, and they would kind of talk a bit, and they weren't very interested in what was going on, and they would be a little bit troublesome, but then things changed, and they became very interested, and they were writing notes, and they were very attentive and staring at the preacher throughout the sermon. And so people were noticing this, and Douglas Macmillan sat down with them and said, so lads, you know, when did you start to change?" And they were kind of, "Change? What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, you know, you've become so much more attentive in the services." And they said, "Oh, no, we haven't changed. It's just that your preaching suddenly became interesting." And of course, Douglas Macmillan's preaching hadn't changed at all, but they were being changed, and their outlook changed completely as they were being changed by the Holy Spirit. And perhaps then just this quite trivial little detail of Naaman suddenly wanting the very soil that he found so repulsive before is just a little reminder that he's a converted man, and our whole outlook changes in conversion. And that's a hope to hold out for those in your family and those of your friends who you could never imagine being here on a Sunday or wanting to talk about Jesus or singing a hymn of praise. Who knows? Who knows what God might do in them? But the main point here then, as I say, is Naaman taking this soil as an aid memoir. In other words, he's ensuring that he maintains this worship of Yahweh that he's now pledged himself to. He's doing something. He's doing something big and costly to ensure that his worship of Yahweh is maintained over the years. And again then, that is an implication that comes with experiencing God's grace, isn't it? And we start to make decisions in life then based on what is most conducive to the maintenance of our Christian discipleship. And we might be offered a great job but it's in a place where there's not a gospel church. Or it's a job where we're going to have to work often on a Sunday. And so we think, well, I'm not going to take that job. Because what matters most is that 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, I'm still following Jesus Christ. Not that my career has advanced. Not that I'm earning a great salary. But that I'm still following Jesus Christ. Maintenance of our discipleship becomes this great priority that affects what we do. We start to try and future-proof our Christian discipleship. That's an implication of experiencing God's grace. Confession, maintenance. And then one more word, navigation. Navigation. We have Naaman continuing, don't we, in verse 18. In this matter, may the Lord pardon your servant. When my master goes into the house of Rimmon to worship there, leaning on my arm, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, when I bow myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardon your servant in this matter. And here then, we have Naaman wrestling with what it means now to be a worshipper of Yahweh in the stuff of his daily life. We have him here navigating the routines and the habits and the furnishings of his life now as a worshipper of Yahweh. And what particularly comes to his mind as he's talking to Elisha is the way in which he accompanies the king regularly into the temple of Rimmon. Now, people get in a stew about verse 18 here. I think that the most convincing explanation of it remains the one that John Calvin wrote many years ago now. Something that Naaman here is saying, is it okay if I feign worship of Rimmon? I'll bow down and look like I'm worshipping Rimmon, but I won't really be doing that in my heart. And Elisha says, yes, that's fine. I don't think that's the case. I think that would, in a stroke, really remove pretty much all the need for any Christian martyrdoms ever, wouldn't it? If it was okay just to feign the worship of pagan gods, then Christians would very rarely in history have been killed for their faith. Christians have been killed for their faith because, like those men in the book of Daniel, they refuse to bow down. They refuse to feign even the worship of pagan gods. And Calvin then says, no, that's not what this is about. And he was right. It's in a long letter, actually, that he sets out his understanding of this passage, and it relates to those who were saying, well, it's okay to believe the newly rediscovered doctrines of the Reformation and yet still go along to Mass and just kind of pretend that you're going along with it when you're not really. And Calvin, and they would appeal to this story, and Calvin says, no, you can't do that. That's not what this is about. And Calvin said that it's just a very practical matter, that the bowing down here isn't worship or even feigned worship. It's simply about physical posture that he's supporting the king. I'll read you what Calvin says. He says, he asked permission for nothing else than simply that of accommodating himself to the bending posture of the king whom he was supporting and holding up. This was not to feign worship to an idol, but to perform duty and service to his sovereign. He was holding the king up. The king was bowing down, and so Naaman had to bow down in order to keep the king supported and stop him from falling over. It's as simple as that, Calvin says. And I think that's probably the best explanation of this. I mean, people knew that Naaman was a worshipper of Yahweh now. He was sacrificing to Yahweh every day. And his confession was that there's no God in all the earth but in Israel. And so he'd already blown his cover. He didn't need to feign this worship of Rimmon. And that's not then what he's doing. But the real point I'm making is that here we have this man, and he's thinking then through the details of his life and what it's going to mean now that he's a worshipper of Yahweh, and what that will mean in this area of his life, and what that will mean in this area of his life, and where lines must be drawn, what is okay and what's not okay. In other words, he's not compartmentalizing his life. He's not saying that all Yahweh requires is that I offer those burnt offerings to him. And that's all that Yahweh's interested in, and the rest of life, I do what I want. No, he realizes that all of life matters now. And he's seeking to navigate the details of life. And so does every person who's experienced God's grace. It's not just about going to church on a Sunday and then Monday to Saturday, anything goes. But it means all kinds of decisions. Is it okay for me to work for this employer? Is it okay for me to go along with this work policy? Is it okay for me to study this course? And asking these questions, grappling with the implications now of being a follower of Jesus Christ, navigating all the details of life as such a person. And so I hope you see then these two realities that we've looked at tonight, and how they're both true, that God's grace is costless. We do not earn salvation or pay for it in any shape or form, but God's grace is costly. You experience it and you're not the same. And you don't just go back to how life was. It leaves a mark on you. It leaves you different. It leaves you confessing these new things that might get you hated. It leaves you prioritizing the maintenance of your discipleship and making decisions on that basis. It leaves you navigating every part of life now as a worshipper of Jesus Christ. May we be clear then on both these things, the costlessness of God's grace and the costliness too of that same grace of God. Amen. Well, let's close singing number 816, which takes up that last theme we considered of Naaman now, kind of navigating all of life as a worshipper of Yahweh. Fill thou my life, O Lord my God, in every part with praise. Look at verse 6. So shall no part of day or night from sacredness be free, but all my life in every step be fellowship with thee. Let's sing number 816.